This is Positive Parenting. Parenting expertise and advice from best-selling parenting author and national newspaper columnist, Mr. Dad, Armin Brott.
Hello and welcome to today's Positive Parenting Show. I'm Armin Brott. Now, as parents, we've all heard about helicopter parents and the boomerang children, but how can parents safeguard against both of those things when our children's lives are scheduled up to the hilt and competitive? Overprotection and micromanagement is something that keeps young kids from the self-development that comes naturally from learning and doing on their own. The time from birth to age six, which is when busy parents are most tempted to do things for their kids like tying their shoes or cooking special food for picky eaters, is also, according to the latest research in neuroscience, when children's brains are becoming organized, and that makes them the most developmentally important years for establishing self-sufficiency. Children who don't learn independence skills at an appropriate age, well, they grow into adults who expect others to fix their challenges and conflicts for them. They never learn how to do anything on their own. In this part of today's show, we're going to be speaking with pediatrician Alana Levine, who's got a refreshing but still authoritative new voice in the parenting arena. She's got a common sense approach that finds a nice, healthy balance between the overindulgence of free-range kids and the strict control of tiger moms. She's going to give us the tools that we need to teach and model independence for our kids, but also she's going to give us the peace of mind that our children will be developing the skills that they need to become confident and capable adults.
More with Mr. Dad, Armin Brott, after this, from the MrDad.com radio network.
Salagadoola, Mitchagaboola, bibbidi-bobbidi-boo.
You must be your fairy godmother. Yes.
It doesn't take a fairy godmother to tell you that the right fit means everything.
Good. Heavens, child, you can't go in that.
Children under 4'9" need to be in a booster seat because they aren't ready for adult safety belts alone. Many parents miss the important step of booster seats.
Maybe you better explain things to him.
Booster seats raise your child up so that a safety belt designed for adults will fit and protect them properly.
Oh, that does make a difference.
Remember that 4'9" is the magic number, and get your little pumpkin there safely in a booster seat.
Hop in, my dear. Oh, thank you.
And like Cinderella, you can live happily ever after.
It's like a dream, a wonderful dream come true.
For more information, visit boosterseat.gov. This has been a message from the U.S. Department of Transportation and the Ad Council.
Now, get ready for more positive parenting with Armin Brott from the MrDad.com radio network.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott, and my guest for this part of today's show is Dr. Alana Levine, who's the author of Raising a Self-Reliant Child, a back-to-basics parenting plan from birth to age six. Alana, thanks for joining us. Great to have you.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Let's talk about self-reliance. Obviously, that's the topic of the book, but I wouldn't associate self-reliance with anything that's even remotely close to birth. How do you work that in there?
Well, my philosophy is that it's a parent's job to sort of guide their children through self-reliance. And when you first bring your newborn baby home from the hospital, they're completely reliant on you for everything, to eat, to help get to sleep, to change a dirty diaper. But little by little, as your child gets older, it's the parent's job to sort of transfer that responsibility for care from the parent onto the child when it's developmentally appropriate. And I find that if parents sort of have this idea in their mind from the beginning, they're sort of primed and ready to go to sort of give that child responsibility. Now, does that mean a four-month-old is going to be able to feed themselves completely? No, but certainly a four-month-old can learn how to self-soothe a little bit, can fuss for a couple of minutes in the crib, get back to sleep themselves without parental intervention. So from a very young age, if parents sort of empower their children and guide them towards self-reliance, that little bit goes a long way when you're raising adolescents and young adults.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but I'm thinking at the very beginning, especially, particularly for first-time parents, the idea of letting their child cry for a little bit longer than might be comfortable or and you know, anything like that would be hard. Really, really
it is,
hard.
And it's and it's challenging, and that's why you sort of have to be thoughtful and mindful of it. And that's not to say that you shouldn't love your children and nurture your children and hug them and rock them. I mean, I definitely advocate for that. We want children to feel loved and safe and secure and comforted from the start. But at the same time, kids actually do feel very loved when they feel that their parents believe in them to do things on their own. So, you know, a young child can learn to hold the bottle by themselves. And it doesn't mean that as a parent you don't want to feed your child and you don't want to hold the bottle for him or her, but if your child's holding the bottle, then that gives your hands free space to be able to tickle their neck, play with their hair, play with their feet. So it doesn't have to be mean-spirited. It can still be comforting and nurturing as you allow your children to sort of gain skills as it's developmentally appropriate.
Okay, so let's start with something very early on. Take a skill, the self-soothing, maybe to be able to sleep a little longer through the night. How do you begin with that one?
Right. So generally in the first couple weeks, even the first couple months of life, children really have a hard time sort of blocking out external stimuli and soothing themselves. So during that time period, absolutely, hold your child, rock your child. But around 3-4 months, that's the time period where I encourage parents to sort of put their child down while they're awake. And they may fuss a little bit, and they may, you know, it may take them a little while to sort of figure out how to calm down. But if you give your child that space to do it, and you have a child that goes down to sleep on their own every single time, then that's a child that when they wake up at 2 or 3 in the morning is much more likely to sort of fuss for a moment and calm themselves down than a child who's only been rocked to sleep by you. Because if that child who's only been rocked to sleep by you wakes up in the middle of the night, they're going to expect you're going to rock them back to sleep. And so you become integral in that sleep process. Whereas if you can take a step back a little bit and allow your child to sort of work it out for him or herself, he or she will be much more able to do that in the middle of the night should they wake up.
So again, how does that work with the new parents? The natural temptation is, okay, the baby falls asleep at the breast, because babies do that a lot, pick up the baby and very quietly tiptoe down the hall, put the baby down. So do you advocate jarring the baby just a touch to wake him up?
No, I mean, I think if you have a young newborn that falls asleep on the breast, you can absolutely, you know, gently put them into the crib. But there's, as a child gets older, as that infant gets older, there's going to be a time where that baby is not falling asleep at the breast every single time. And so that at the times where they're awake, that's when you want to sort of put them down to sleep awake. And, you know, certainly during naps in the middle of the day, it's a good habit to get into. And it's not, and while it can be hard for new parents, you know, new parents really need to understand that this is not a mean thing to do. This is a great skill that you're giving your child. I mean, I remember when my kids were younger, I would hear on the monitor, you know, at 6 in the morning, they'd wake up and they'd be cooing and squealing and looking at the mobile, looking at the mirror and playing and amusing themselves for 45 minutes to an hour. And I would just be delighted, you know, that my child was able to be happy without me there. That doesn't mean that I didn't want there to be times where I made my child laugh hysterically. You know, we had great giggle sessions, but it was a great feeling for me as a parent to know that I could make my child happy, but that my child could also be happy by herself.
Now, how do you reconcile, actually talk a little bit about the difference between Mark Weissbluth's method and Dr. Ferber's method? I've had Mark on the show, I guess, a couple times, and have not been able to get Dr. Ferber on, but there are a couple of different methods, and both of those are fairly widespread. What's the difference?
Right. So, I mean, I'm a big believer in the Weissbluth method, and I when I was, you know, a new parent myself, I read his book, and it really sort of sung true to me, and I loved his notion that the more sleep children get, the more sleep they'll want, so that it's this sort of natural instinct to say, oh, I really want my child to sleep late, so I'm going to keep my child up later.
Right.
And that doesn't really work. Then you end up with an overtired baby that doesn't have a good night's sleep, and you sort of get caught in this vicious cycle. So that was one of the things that Weissbluth advocates that really sort of rings true to me. And another thing is looking for sleepiness cues. You know, you don't want to miss that golden opportunity. So at the point where your child is fussing, that's too late. You really want to see the yawn, the rubbing of the eyes, you know, and right away sort of listen to your baby's cues and put your child to sleep. You know, Weissbluth talks about different methods of sort of crying it out. And one of the methods that he talks about is something called total extinction, where you just let your baby cry, if they wake up in the middle of the night, you just let your baby cry until he or she falls back asleep. Whereas Ferber, who also believes in crying it out, has a much more scheduled method of, you know, starting at a few minutes, going in and checking on the baby, adding a couple minutes. And I find that Ferber's method works really nicely sometimes for new parents because they need that sort of that discrete scheduled plan. And I think that with Ferber's method, it sort of shifts the focus from the baby crying to watching the clock. And I think that that makes it a lot easier for parents sometimes. But I think they're both of them sort of intersect on the idea that, you know, kids need sleep. And as parents, if we can really, you know, tough it out and get them to figure out how to go back to sleep on their own, that ultimately you're going to have a child that sleeps much better, better rested parents, better rested children, and that with each stage of development and each change in the child's sleep patterns, you can sort of go back to those methods and help your child get back to sleeping through the night.
Now, where do you stand on pacifiers? I know that's kind of, they've come in and out of fashion at various points, and the American Academy of Pediatrics fairly recently said that they actually reduce the risk of SIDS, sudden infant death syndrome. So where
right.
are you so, on that now?
So my feeling is that you can't force a child who doesn't want a pacifier to take a pacifier, but that once breastfeeding has been well established, you can introduce a pacifier to see if it's soothing for a child. And because there have been studies to show that that pacifiers can decrease the risk of SIDS, you know, I definitely think that it's a good thing. It's a good tool to use for babies who need a little extra soothing, but not something that I would force on a baby who doesn't. That being said, I've also found from my own personal experience with my children and also in my practice that if you wait too long to take the pacifier away, it can become more and more difficult and more of a challenge. So for a young infant, you know, less than 6 months, who really is just learning how to soothe themselves, it's a great tool. But once a child gets to be 9 months, 12 months, that's a time where they can sort of figure out other methods for soothing themselves. And I generally recommend taking the pacifier away somewhere between 9 and 12 months.
We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk with Alana about things like potty training and when the appropriate time to do that is, managing food fights at mealtime, when do you use a pacifier, when do you stop using a pacifier, and of course, the dangers of praising our kids too much. All that and a lot more is coming up after the break. I'm Armin Brott, and you're listening to Positive Parenting.
More with Mr. Dad. Armin Brott, after this, from the MrDad.com radio network.
My name's Tyler, and in 9 years, I'll be an alcoholic. I'll start drinking in middle school, just at parties. But my parents won't start talking to me about it till high school.
Kids who drink before age 15 are 5 times more likely to have alcohol problems when they're adults.
The thing is, my parents won't even see it coming.
So start talking before they start drinking. To learn more, go to StopAlcoholAbuse.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, the Ad Council, and this station.
Hands can do incredible things. This is the sound of 326 hands playing Mozart. This is the sound of 10,942 hands showing appreciation. 64 hands building a house for the homeless. 142 hands swimming a triathlon. 18 hands winning the big game. And this is the sound of 2 hands helping to save a life. It's called hands-only CPR, and it's recommended by the American Heart Association. If an adult suddenly collapses, call 911, then push hard and fast in the center of their chest until help arrives. It's incredibly easy and effective. Hands can do incredible things. But nothing compares to using them to help save a life. Find out more about this latest method of CPR at handsonlycpr.org. A message from the American Heart Association and the Ad Council.
Bullying is not kids being kids.
It's not about good homes or bad homes.
It's not a normal part of growing up. I shouldn't be afraid to get on the school bus.
To turn on my computer.
Message.
A lock to my locker.
Did you know that a bully will stop his or her behavior in 10 seconds when their peers speak up?
Use your voice.
Hey, leave him alone.
We have the power to stop bullying.
Find out more at bullying.org.
Where you're not alone.
Get ready for more positive parenting with Armin Brott from the MrDad.com radio network.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott. Continuing our discussion with Alana Levine, if you're just joining us, and she's the author of Raising a Self-Reliant Child, a Back to Basics Parenting Plan from Birth to Age 6. So let's move ahead a little bit. I mean, we could spend the whole show talking about what's going on with babies because they're so fascinating. But eventually they grow up or they get older. Whether they grow up or not is debatable, I guess, if you've had teenagers. So what are some of the issues that are faced, or the self-reliance issues that are being dealt with by kids who are, say, 1 to 3, somewhere in that? They've started to walk, they're not going to school yet, so they're hanging around with a parent or a caregiver most of the time.
Right. So a big topic that I talk about every day in my office is toilet training. And parents are always asking me how you know when your child is ready to toilet train. And my philosophy on toilet training is to really let the child decide when he or she is ready. And the reason why is because if you think about what toilet training means, it means that the child is now taking ownership and taking responsibility for deciding when they need to go to the bathroom and actually making it to the bathroom. And so if it's the parent that decides, oh, I know they're ready, I know they can sense when they need to go, I'm going to put them in underwear, and then they become what I call the potty police, which is every 2 seconds saying, do you have to go to the bathroom, do you have to go to the bathroom, do you have to go to the bathroom, basically you're toilet training the parents to guess right, and you're not actually toilet training the child to be aware of his or her body. So I have found, from my experience, both with my own children and with my patients, that if parents just introduce the topic of the toilet, read books, watch videos, take them into the bathroom with you when you're going, and completely leave the decision up to the child, you're going to have a child that's going to have a much shorter window of learning how to toilet train and will have much fewer accidents than if you engage in that power struggle and chase them around all the time, begging them to go to the bathroom.
No, I have a time where I teach classes, I guess, every month for expectant and new dads, and it's a different group every time. And I always get this question about when they say, well, our neighbor down the street or somebody read a book and they said that they had their baby toilet trained at 6 months. And my response to that has always been something kind of along the lines of what you just said, is it really probably is more a question of the parents being toilet trained to recognize the signs and dash their child off to the bathroom. When is a child physically able to recognize the sensations and to actually associate the feelings with control?
So, I mean, I know the books that you're talking about, there's a type of parenting, and especially in other cultures outside of the United States.
Sweden,
where
it's always Sweden.
The moms are holding the babies all the time, and they can sense when they need to go, and they put them onto the toilet when they're infants, and then as these infants get older, they crawl to the toilet where they need to go. But that's not really the norm, and that's not really what happens in our culture. And so my feeling is, in our culture, it's really much better to just introduce the concept and let children decide when it is they want to go. I mean, I think that it's natural to compare your child to your neighbor's child, but really at the end of the day, I mean, no one's getting into Harvard because they toilet trained earlier. Nobody really cares. It's not at all a reflection of your child's intelligence or how much they know and how much they can do. It's really a matter of when they have the bladder maturity, when they have the bowel maturity, and when emotionally they're ready.
Okay, that's sensible advice. All right, so let's go on to meal times then. This is another area. I mean, I guess all of these are areas where parents are torturing themselves and everybody else around them. But so meal times, it's so easy to fall into the, I don't know if it's a pattern of just like eating only the things that your child wants, which ends up usually with the white food group, basically.
Right.
How do you begin to introduce other foods that are going to be attractive? And so I say this knowing that the kids who grow up in Thailand are having chili peppers by the time they're 6 months. And so it's possible
right.
for
think,
kids to
and
have
I think
other
part
foods.
Part of the reason that is because that's what they're exposed to and that's what they're seeing their family members model for them. So that really highlights point, which is if you can eat meals as a family, I would encourage you to do so. And I realize, you know, with a lot of people's work schedules, that's not always possible. But anytime, even if it's just one parent can sit down with the children and have a meal, I think you're the best teacher by example. So if your children see you eating green vegetables and healthy foods, they're much more likely to eat it themselves. I'm also a big believer in sort of engaging children in the meal preparation and planning process. So, for instance, you can sit down on a Sunday and say, what are the meals we're going to have this week? You know, Susie, you get to choose one meal that we're having this week. The whole family will eat whatever you want on Tuesday, for instance. And in return, Susie's going to eat what you want on Wednesday. And that doesn't mean that you're going to force feed Susie because you don't want to engage in a power struggle. But you can encourage her just to try it, and I think she'll be more likely to try it if she's been involved in the process. Take her to the grocery store with you, have her help you pick out the foods, have her help you cook the foods. If you can do that, she'll be much more likely to eat something that she feels proud and feels ownership over. One of the other things that I say is if a child doesn't like what's being served, then they can help themselves to something else that's healthy in the kitchen. So I like to avoid mom or dad becoming sort of the short order cook where they prepare a meal. No, I don't want that. Oh, well, what do you want? Do you want me to make this? Do you want me to make this? Do you want me to make this? If your child doesn't want to eat what's on the table, you don't have to offer suggestions. You can say to your child, you know, there are healthy things in the refrigerator. There are healthy things, you know, in the pantry that can be heated up easily in a microwave by you. Go help yourself to something if you don't like what's on the table. And then you avoid that power struggle of, if you don't get three more bites of your broccoli, you can't have dessert, because that's just really a setup for uncomfortable, unhappy meals.
Okay. So an area, skipping a little bit further ahead, that is real torture for a lot of parents is, how do you begin to teach kids to share? That seems to be one of the big issues that's going to have to do with self-reliance, is in a way how to teach the kid to share and then how to teach a kid to deal with another child who isn't sharing.
Right. You know, that can be a real challenge. And again, the best thing that you can do is lead by example. So you can be a good sharer yourself, and you need to share with your child, you need to share with your friends, with your spouse, and you need to make a point of saying, look, I'm sharing. And anytime your child shares, praise them lavishly. It's much, much more effective to give positive reinforcement than it is to give negative reinforcement. But ultimately, you want your child to share because it feels good to share, not because they've been forced to share. So, you know, those instances where they do share and they're doing what they're supposed to be doing, if you make them feel good about themselves, they're going to start to feel good just in sharing themselves. Obviously, there are going to be certain things that are absolutely precious toys to your child, and maybe that's something that you wouldn't encourage them to share. So if they're having a friend come over, you know, that's something you might want to put away, or, you know, hide behind a closed cabinet door so that your child doesn't have to share, you know, their most favorite stuffed animal or something. But, you know, the other things that are around the house, the other toys and things, you know, I think your child will feel much more comfortable sharing if they know that their most special thing they don't need to share.
Now, you talked a little bit about, speaking of praise, about the risks of praising too much.
Right. I think that our children will believe what we say when we say what we mean. And so every piece of scribble-scrabble artwork, you know, is not a Picasso drawing. And so I think that you need to save your super-duper-duper praise for when your child does something really super-duper. That being said, you can still comment on a piece of artwork even if it's not a Monet or a Picasso. And you can talk about the colors that your child used, or you can ask why they decided to choose that shape. You can show interest in what your child has done without telling them that it's the most wonderful thing. Because ultimately, as children get older, they're not going to be the best at everything. And you want them to understand from an early age sort of how to deal with that feeling of not always doing everything right and not always succeeding.
That's a really tough one, because, I mean, all the studies about self-esteem that people have heard about for years and years and years always were talking about, oh, you have to praise constantly and tell your kid, oh, you're the best. And what you're saying is that that kind of backfires.
You know, I think you can instill self-esteem in your child even more so if you praise them for the things that are really accomplishments. I mean, you don't want to have a child that feels like they can't believe what their parent says because you know the parent's always going to say something good. I mean, all kids have good qualities and all kids do nice things. So there's plenty of opportunity to praise when it's deserved.
Alana Levine is the author of Raising a Self-Reliant Child, a Back-to-Basics Parenting Plan from Birth to Age 6. Alana, thanks for joining us. Great to have you.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
I'm 4 years old, and I'm the only one in my whole class that can tie his own shoes.
My mom took me to the circus for my birthday. Half my friends already went, but now I've gone too.
Most kids make fun of me because I still believe in the tooth fairy. But I got $5 yesterday. I believe.
A third of the kids in my eighth grade class drink alcohol regularly.
Over 99% of my class has been offered illegal drugs.
Half of my college classmates binge drink, abuse drugs, or do both. But the frequent dinners I had with my family have helped make sure I'm not one of them.
Go to CasaFamilyDay.org. Take the Family Day Pledge and get tips on how to talk to your kids about drugs and alcohol. Have dinner with them often, and you can significantly lower their risk of substance abuse. Dinner makes a difference. A message from the National Center on Addiction and Substance Abuse at Columbia University.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott, and we're back again for this week's Parents at Play column, where we are reviewing toys and games from the parents' perspective, things you can do with your kids. And you can get more of these reviews, by the way, at parentsatplay.com. And I'm joined by Samantha Fuse, who is my writing partner on the Parents at Play column. And both of us wanted to talk a little bit about cooking with kids and some of the great things. You had an opportunity to test out a whole bunch of really cool products. And one of them was the green pan. Tell us what that's about. It's an intriguing name. It's not actually green, but it's green.
Well, no, it's not actually green. Ours was actually red. it's a nonstick pan, but it's not a traditional one. It's got a ceramic coating to help the food slide off easily. And something I thought was cool was it was very heat resistant, much more heat resistant than many other things on the market. So if you accidentally overheat the pan, if you are a cooking novice, when you're cooking with your child, for example, and, you know, things get a little, hey, we're playing a little too much or whatever. I don't mean playing with fire. I just mean, like, you know, you're experimenting. It won't burn the pan. It won't have any kind of heat marks, and it won't burn the food, which is awesome. Something else that I enjoyed about it is it's actually almost impossible to blister or peel, and there's nothing in it that's going to release bad fumes. It also came with a bamboo cutting board on top, and when you're finished cutting, you could just shove everything right into the pan, which my son thought was funny. Like, he thought it was like a fun little game, like a puzzle.
You know, one thing I thought was interesting about this too, my parents actually have one of these, and my mom is constantly reminding me when I'm over there that you don't need very much oil with these things.
You can do almost no oil at all.
Yeah, I mean, so you're helping with the eating healthy food kind of part of the green thing too.
Absolutely, and you know, sometimes less is much more.
Yeah. Hey, so talk about the, is it Twist or Twizzit? How do you pronounce that?
That's a great question. I actually think it's Twizzit, but I'm not positive. It would be great if some products came with pronunciation guides, wouldn't it?
It's T-W-I-Z-T-T.
Yes.
Yeah, and it's by Joan London, who some of you may remember. So what's that about? What's the twist about?
What I thought was kind of cool was, again, with the ceramic nonstick coating. And it was like a whole kind of kit. They call it the cook, cut, and serve kit. It has everything you need, like the cutting board. It has a little bowl that you can bring with it, so you can do everything. You can cook it, mix it up, chop it up, heat it, serve it, everything in the same container. So that's kind of cool for not just dinner, but like if you're having a party or if you're taking it with you to go. I thought that was a cool aspect of it. And it's inexpensive. It's affordable. A lot of pans that are ceramic tend to be a little on the pricey side. And this one was on the more affordable side. And everything but the cutting board is able to be put in the dishwasher, which I think most people will appreciate.
So you can get the green pan. Their website is green-pan.us, and the twist is twist.com, but it's
T-W-I-Z-T-T.com.
Exactly. And you can find out more reviews and more. We reviewed quite a few more cooking with kids options at parentsatplay.com. I'm Armin Brott.
And I'm Samantha Fuse.
Thanks for listening to Positive Parenting. You can get more information on today's show and what we're working on in the weeks ahead at MrDad.com. While you're there, visit the MrDad.com gift shop with everything you need to help you become the dad or mom you want to be. Positive Parenting is a production of the MrDad.com radio network. Now, go be a great parent.